So, the last few weeks we've been talking about the sevenfold puja. And we've been looking at the stages of the sevenfold puja as practices in themselves. So each stage is a practice in itself. And this is part of a whole path of practice for the bodhisattva, for the aspiring bodhisattva. Starts with the four, what are called the four preliminaries. We probably know them sometimes as the four reminders. So the reflection on the precious human opportunity, reflection on the inevitability of death, reflection on karma, and reflecting on the faults of samsara. Those are the four preliminaries that we reflect on. And then the next stage of the path, there are different practices, but the Shantideva's Sevenfold Puja represents one of these practices of the next stage of the path. If I don't know if you've come across the Jewel Ornament of Liberation by Gampopa. In there you find this path laid out, and he's got two or three different practices for this, for the middle section, but Shantideva's puja, as we know as the puja, is one of those practices. And then what follows on from that is the six, or actually it's the ten paramitas, but usually it's just the six paramitas you see. So the last stage of the sevenfold puja represents the arising of the bodhicitta. It represents this kind of eruption or explosion of compassion, basically, of a kind of urge to practice for the sake of self and others. So yes, for compassion. So what I'm going to be looking at this evening is the six paramitas, which we usually translate as the six perfections. I'm not sure if perfection is a good translation or not. The para bit means supreme, something is supreme. And the mitta bit means something that's established or set up. So it's something that's supremely established or supremely set up. So taking the practice to its utmost, as it were, that's what it's about. So we usually translate it as the perfections, the perfecting, I guess, of the practice. And the six perfections, which I'm sure you all know, are dana, generosity, sila, ethics, virya, kshanti, virya, energy, kshanti, patience, forbearance. Actually, it's the other way around, I think. It's usually virya and then kshanti. And then samadhi, concentration, and then prajna, wisdom. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to do a reflection on each one of them. I'm not necessarily going to give you a kind of exposition of the six paramitas and go into them really deeply or whatever. I'm just going to say something about each one. And it might be a little bit idiosyncratic because I'm just going to say what I've been reflecting on about each one and what it's brought to mind for me. So the first one is dana, generosity. And, well, generosity, we practice, first of all, at the level of the precepts, where, well, the second precept, we talk about not taking the not given. So that's the starting point, as it were. And then we talk about open-handed generosity. And now we're on to the dana paramita, the perfection of giving, which the perfection of giving is where there's less and less attachment. So there's less and less, if you like, an experience of giving, strangely enough. So the perfection of giving is less and less like giving because there isn't an attachment to whatever. There isn't a sense of possession and ownership. That's not so strong. Because the whole kind of ego sense, the whole sense of ego identity is less strong. So that whole kind of lack of attachment leads to a natural kind of giving, a natural, spontaneous, generosity. Yes, the sort of generosity where you hardly think about it. One way of thinking what it's like is just thinking of things that you do quite naturally without thinking about it. If somebody drops something on the floor, you just pick it up and give it to them, you know, if they haven't noticed. You don't think about it, you know, it's not like a kind of major act for you, as it were. And so the bodhisattva's generosity is like that, or is aiming to be like that. That's what it would be like when it's supremely established, you know, or perfected. And one of the side effects of non-attachment, or less and less attachment, is that the world becomes more beautiful. Because if we're relating to things less in terms of possession or ownership or grasping or clinging, then they just become aesthetic. Everything becomes aesthetic. People and objects and everything becomes much more of an aesthetic experience. So the bodhisattva, in a sense, the dharma, is a sharing of aesthetic experience, you could say. And a sense of abundance comes into that. But what I was mainly reflecting on or looking at around this was not so much giving as in what to give or anything like that, but in the Pali Canon, and again in the Mahayana scriptures, in for instance the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, it talks about how to give. And I just found that interesting, this thing about how to give, right, and what to give or whatever, how. And so for instance in the Anguttara Nikaya, it talks about five ways that a person of integrity gives. So a person of integrity, or I think Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as a good man or something like that. It's sapurissa. Sap means true. Purissa is translated usually as either a man or a person or an individual. You see it in the Tiratnavandana. Yeah, that's it. And it's in the first verse as well, I think. So, in fact, you could even say Sapurissa could be translated as a true individual, which is a term that Bhante uses a lot. So this Tanisara Bhikkhu translated as person of integrity. So the person of integrity, this is how they give. They give, first of all, with a sense of conviction or faith. Yeah. Secondly, they give attentively or carefully. Thirdly, they give at the right time. Fourthly, they give with respect, respectfully. Yeah. And fifthly, they give without causing harm to self or other, without causing injury to self or other. And there are a few other additions to that elsewhere in the, I think it's in the Majjhima Nikaya. It says that the person of integrity gives with their own hand. They don't, what's the word, delegate it to somebody else. Give with their own hand. They don't give something that's about to be discarded. They don't give something that they were going to throw away, basically. So they give something that is of value to them. Yeah? And they give knowing that something will come of it. So that's quite an interesting one. I think the first one, giving with a sense of faith or a sense of conviction, and the last one, giving knowing that something will come of it, actually you're talking about the same thing. What they're talking about is karma. So knowing that something will come of it, or giving with faith, means you're giving knowing that actually this is a skillful action. You're aware that it's a skillful action to give. So that's one of the things in how to give. Giving with the knowledge that it's a skillful thing to do. The second one, giving attentively, giving carefully. So, of course, it's giving with awareness, isn't it? Giving mindfully. So you're aware of what you're doing, aware of the other person. You're aware of what's appropriate to give them, and so on. Giving at the right time. I take that to mean giving appropriately. giving at the right time. Yes. You probably would think of examples, I suppose. I can't think of one off the top of my head, but I suppose if somebody's just experienced a major loss or something, you don't give at the time when it's right for you. You give at the time when it's right for them. Yeah, to give at the right time. When is the right time to give that particular whatever it is. It might not be a thing. It might be giving empathy or time and energy or whatever. It's the right time to do that. Yeah. The other one was giving with respect, or the other translation is giving with an empathetic heart. So, again, it's to do with your relationship to the other person. How you give is all to do with the relationship to the other person, giving with respect to them. And then giving without harm, to yourself or others, which is an interesting one, isn't it? How would you harm yourself in giving? I guess one way you harm yourself is giving more than you can give, as it were, trying to give more than you can give, whether it's trying to give more in terms of energy or money or whatever. How would you give in a way that would harm others? I suppose giving something that's harmful. You know? Whether that's harmful advice or harmful in the sense of drugs or alcohol or whatever. So giving something that's... Yeah, so how to give. Giving without harming self or others. And giving with your own hand. Again, I take that to be something to do with being respectful and attentive and so on. So those are just some reflections on the Dana Paramita. Those things I've just read out come from the Pali Canon. But you find them as well, not all of them, but pretty much the same things in the Mahayana. For instance, in the Jewel Ornament of Liberation. This one here is not translated as Jewel Ornament of Liberation, but it's the same book. Gems of Dharma, Jewels of Freedom, as it is. Not sure if I can find it now, but it would be in here that the... the ways of giving. Yes, here it is. It says give joyfully, give with respect, give personally, that means with your own hand, at the right time, without harming. Well, here it just says without harming others. This is the Bodhisattva that I'm thinking about also. And impartially. And in order to fulfill wishes. So again, that's attentively. So it's pretty much the same thing that carries on into the Mahayana texts as well. Okay, so that's Dana. Then moving on to Sila, the ethics. Well, the Bodhisattva ethics are on, they talk about them on three levels. This comes from Asanga. Asanga was, I can't remember Asanga's dates. Can anyone remember when Asanga was alive? I think it was around the 8th or 9th century, somewhere around. He was alive when Buddhism was at its height. So Asanga was born in present-day Pakistan, near Peshawar in Pakistan. Buddhism was at its height. It was all over Afghanistan, Pakistan, that area that we know now as Afghanistan and Pakistan, which is the area where Buddhism encountered Greek culture. So we find the images of Buddhism and so on that come from that area. The Gandharan Buddhas are influenced by Greek sculpture. They're very beautiful. There's some in the British Museum. And what Asanga did, Asanga was brought together. He was someone who tried to make sense of everything that he'd received in terms of the Buddhist tradition. So he was bringing it all together. His great work is the Yogacara Bhumi. And in that, there's a section, chapter 6, on the Bodhisattva Bhumi, which is about partly about Bodhisattva ethics, and he talks there about the three levels of ethics, which again is repeated in Gampopa in the Journal of Ornamental Liberation several centuries later. And the three levels are, first level is the level of what they call Sangra Shila, which is the level of restraint. So refraining from doing things, refraining from killing living beings, refraining from false speech, refraining from. And it also, of course, includes personal precepts for ourselves, refraining from eating too much, refraining from excessive use of technology, or whatever it is that is our particular bugbear. So that's the first level, is the level of restraint. Yeah? The second level is what's called Kusala Dharma Parigraha Shila. So Parigraha is translated using as accumulation. Kusala Dharma is positive state, positive mental states, skillful mental states. So it's the accumulation of skillful mental states, the ethics that's to do with the accumulation of skillful mental states. And for us, this is enshrined in our positive precepts. So the positive precepts are about the accumulation of skillful mental states, open-handed generosity, deeds of loving kindness, and truthful speech, kindly speech, and so on. That is the accumulation of skillful or positive mental states. So that's the second level of ethics. And then the third level of ethics, Sattva Artha Kriya Shila, is usually translated as something like benefiting living beings. Ethics for the sake of benefiting living beings or for the welfare of living beings. So this is as a word of Bodhisattva ethics proper, where it's not about oneself anymore. It's not about restraining yourself. It's not even about accumulating positive mental states. It's about benefiting living beings. And this is when the ethics becomes also not just personal, it's also collective. It's when you start cooperating, working with others. That is part of the ethic, as it were. It's cooperative, because it's not about yourself anymore. And it's about enhancing life for yourself and others. So it includes things like friendliness and befriending people and empathy and rejoicing, all of those things. Asanga had a list of, I think, 11 things under this heading. Gampopa has 13. So I'll just give you some of the things that come under the heading of the ethics for the benefit of living beings. So the first one is supporting those who are doing worthwhile activities. So it's being helpful, basically. Second is removing the sufferings of beings in torment. So if somebody's badly suffering, you have to try and help them to relieve the suffering before anything else. Teaching those who lack skill in how to cope, or teaching those who lack skill how to cope intelligently. So education, giving skills, and so on. Appreciating what has been done for yourself and acting accordingly. So it's to do with out of gratitude, out of a sense of gratitude, you act to benefit others because you realize that you yourself have benefited. Protecting beings from what frightens them, so giving confidence, giving fearlessness, and that kind of thing. Bringing together a Dharma following. So this is sometimes called the Bodhisattva's act of gathering, which is to do with, it's to do with creating Sangha, basically. It's to do with creating Sangha, which, of course, again, is a collective thing. It's not that Bodhisattva creates a Sangha, but enters into cooperation with others. Making people happy through the very finest of qualities, it says. So it's a radiating good qualities, and so on. One of them is about inspiring awe. These are exceptional abilities, but yes, it's a very high ideal. So those are the three levels: restraining, accumulating positive mental states, and then benefiting others. Those are the three levels of ethics, the Bodhisattva ethics, which, as I say, was initially it was a Sangha who came up with those levels initially as a way of kind of bringing together all of the Buddhist dharma that came to him. But that's still the Mahayana way of talking about it. Okay, so then there's Kshanti. Kshanti, well, there are three elements to Kshanti as well. You can talk about it in terms of patience, forbearance, and receptivity. So Kshanti is as patience. Well, it's usually talked about in terms of the opposite to anger and irritation. So it's patience with yourself, patience with others, patience with the progress you're making on the path and things like that. And then as, what did I say the second one was? Forbearance. No, it's actually sometimes it's, patience and forbearance is probably the same thing. It's endurance is what I meant, endurance. Endurance is, so patience, you're being patient with other people. So endurance is putting up with things that you can't avoid. So such as the weather I think traditionally, if you look in the Bodhicharya Avatara on that section, it talks about things like mosquitoes and biting insects and things like that. Yeah. So things that you can't avoid. Putting up, as it were, without complaining with the vicissitudes of life. Illness. Well, for us it's often illness, it's the weather. Disappointments, things like that. So just enduring in that sense, so that we're not spreading our despondency or negativity among people. So patience, endurance, and then receptivity. Well, receptivity to teachers, receptivity to the Dharma, receptivity to feedback, receptivity to ourselves as well, receptivity to what's going on with ourselves, you know. So those are the three elements of Kshanti: patience, endurance, and receptivity. I don't think I'll say anything more about that. I gave a lot of talks one time on Kshanti, so look them up if you wanted to. Virya. Virya is about effort. Bhante is translated as energy in pursuit of the good. Which is a pretty good way of thinking about it. But it's about effort, and it's about having the motivation, in a way, the motivation to practice. So you could, under the heading of virya, you could think of things like faith, shraddha, devotion, reverence, all of these things that actually, whatever it is that creates the emotional dynamo which enables us to practice, enables us to turn up here on Tuesday night or whatever it is, that kind of enthusiasm, that energy to practice. Bhante has talked about energy in terms of the main problems with energy is that it can be blocked, wasted, or too coarse. So you've probably all heard this, energy blocked, wasted, or too poor. So the task, if your energy is blocked, is to unblock it. So get it moving, get it flowing. And sometimes that's a matter of something physical, like doing exercise or something like that, because the energy is blocked, as it were, in your body. So yoga, tai chi, all of those things. Get the energy moving. Sometimes it might be a matter of communication. the energy is blocked because you've never actually been able to communicate what's important to you. Nobody's ever, you know, never encountered anyone who whom you could communicate with. So sometimes it's a matter of communication. Sometimes it may happen spontaneously in meditation. Energy gets unblocked. Well, wasting energy. Well, I think we all know about wasting energy. I mean, you just had Christmas, so I'm sure some of you have been doing all the things that... Distraction wastes energy. All sorts of things waste energy. So less distraction, going on retreat. Well, Bhante talks about in terms of negative emotion. He says the thing that really wastes energy is negative emotion. And so... in order to not waste energy, you have to work on those emotions. I guess, going back to the ethics thing, you work on accumulating skillful mental states through the positive precepts. And then refining energy. Well, again, usually we talk about that through in terms of meditation, in terms of the arts, or in terms of communication again. Communication is a way of refining our energies. But basically, Virya is about effort. So you could think of it in terms of the four right efforts, the effort to develop and maintain positive mental states, and the effort to get rid of and prevent negative mental states. Okay, so... Samadhi. Samadhi is Samadhi Paramita. So usually I think called the perfection of meditation, meditation perfection. I was thinking about Samadhi as the seventh stage on the spiral path. So you're all aware of the spiral path, the positive nidanas. And you get to the point of samadhi, concentration. And the next point after that is knowledge and vision of things as they really are. And what samadhi represents there is not so much concentration as in doing meditation and getting concentrated. It represents the whole... what Bhante talks about is representing the spiritual growth and evolution of your whole being. Yeah. So it's a kind of high-level integration. Because if you think about it, it's not so much your meditation. If you do meditation for half an hour or an hour every day and you get to particular points of concentration, in a way that's not enough to then take you through to knowledge and vision of things as they really are. It needs to be your whole life that's concentrated, if you see what I mean. Your whole life is concentrated towards going for refuge, as we say. Your whole life is concentrated on the three jewels. So it's like intensity, an intensity of practice. And it has this sense of a steady practice over years, taking you to that point of concentration. And that, you could say, applies back down the spiral as well. So it's not so much that you, like faith, for instance, it's not that you have a bit of faith at 10 o'clock in the morning and then run the rest of the day and so on. You're getting your whole life, your whole kind of inner world, as it were, to a level of Shraddha, faith, where that is, as I said earlier, is part of the motivating force in your life, that you have faith in the Dharma, faith in the law of karma, and so on. And so on up the spiral, you know, that happiness and contentment and tranquility. You're trying to get yourself to a point where actually you're a happy person, you're a contented person, you're a tranquil, calm person, not that you have those particular experiences just in meditation, but that they're how your life is. Yeah? So the perfection of samadhi, supreme establishment, as it were, of samadhi, is establishing it in your whole life. So the meditation is important because meditation is like the spearhead of that. It's what for many people will give them stronger experiences of that. But if you're not a great meditator, you shouldn't despair, because you get to that point through lots of different practices. If you are a great meditator, you shouldn't despair either, because you still need all the other practices. So it's the broad practice underpinned by that faith. That's what's required to get moving up the spiral, as it were. Okay, so the prajna paramita, the perfection of wisdom, this is in a way the most important of the perfections, because it should be there in all of them in a way. But different ways of talking about it. You could talk about it in terms of the five wisdoms, for instance, the five wisdoms associated with the five Buddhas, the mirror-like wisdom, and so on. One of the problems with talking about wisdom is that it can get very abstract quite quickly. It moves away from your life, as it were. It feels like it's something else, nothing to do with you. But actually, again, if it's to be something that we perfect, we have to find it in our lives and then, as it were, improve it, build it, let it grow, evolve it, whatever. So if you take something like the mirror-like wisdom, you might start off with just recognizing your own subjectivity. So the mirror-like wisdom is the wisdom that sees everything just as it is, just as it is, without anything added. But what we add is our own subjectivity, our own emotionally flavored interpretations of reality. So part of what we have to do is to try and recognize our own subjectivity and try to be a bit more objective about what's going on, which is not easy, because our own subjectivity is like how we experience the world, as it were, and it seems like that is reality. So part of what the Dharma is telling us is actually our version of reality isn't reality. It isn't reality. It's our version of reality, and we have to kind of find ways of seeing in what way we're distorting reality, as it were. With the wisdom of equality, the wisdom of equality is about, basically it's about seeing that at bottom, as it were, we're all the same. We've all got potential. We've all got great potential, as it were. In fact, the Dharma is saying we've got the potential to awaken, to be Buddhas. And we've also, none of us has a fixed self. None of us has a fixed or separate self or ego. We're all possibly operating under the delusion, not necessarily conscious delusion, but nevertheless operating under that delusion that we do have a fixed self, but none of us have. And in that, we're all equal. In a more practical sense, it's about letting go of pride. Letting go of pride. But perhaps even more basic than that, it's about letting go of making comparisons with others. Yeah. So you don't make comparisons about being better than or less than or equal to others. Equal to, in the sense of talking about in a more superficial sense, equal. So it's letting go of pride. Well, it's actually letting go of pride and humility. I don't know if you've read Bhante's memoirs, the Rainbow Road. In there he talks about meeting this one-eyed guru, Yalahankar Swami, who taught him that humility was just the same as pride, that the two were, as it were, two sides of the same coin. And so it's letting go of pride and humility, as it were. sometimes we're too humble. We don't recognize our own value, our own worth, our own abilities, what we have to give, and so on. And sometimes we're too proud, overconfident. We think we've got an inflated view of ourselves. Most of us are fairly ordinary, with perhaps some abilities that are well developed and so on, but we just have to recognize that. Again, it's a bit like being objective about ourselves. You could say that that is what self-metta is, that metta towards yourself is having a kind of clear view of yourself, a clear view of who you are. So you're not inflating yourself, you're not putting yourself down, you've just got a clear sense of who you are and your value and your worth. Then there's the distinguishing wisdom, which sees the uniqueness of all beings. And this is, again, very important, that we recognize that we are unique. In the parable of the rain cloud, it talks about the rain of the Dharma falling on down on all beings, the same Dharma, the same rain, but all the plants grow according to their own nature. So they all grow differently, as it were. And similarly with us, we all grow differently. We're all different beings. And why that's important is because when you come into a Sangha, a tendency is to think that you need to grow in the way somebody else is growing. You see what I mean? Maybe the person teaching you or whatever, that you have to become like them or whatever. But no, you're a unique individual with a unique set of qualities and so on. And it's those qualities that will grow. It's those positive qualities that grow. The all-accomplishing wisdom of Amoghya Siddhi. So this focuses on action. Amoghya Siddhi is the Buddha of action, as it were. Action being, of course, karma. So you could talk about this in terms of recognizing the truth of karma. So because the poison associated with Amoghya Siddhi is envy. Because envy is when it's like when you see other people doing something, they're acting, as it were, and you're envious of what they're achieving or whatever. The all accomplishing wisdom, as it were, is about acting. It's about doing. It's about it's about having faith and recognizing the truth of the law of karma, so that you put that into action in your life, so to speak. You have confidence that if you act skillfully, you don't have to be concerned about outcomes. Basically, if you act skillfully, it will come. The Dharmadhatu wisdom, which is the wisdom of Varochana, that's the wisdom that includes all the other wisdoms. In a way, you could say this is, in terms of chunking it down a bit, it's penetrating as far as we can into the law of conditionality, Pratijñāsamuppāda, doing as much as we can to understand what that's about and to see how that functions in our lives and in the world. That everything arises in dependence upon conditions, basically. That's kind of like the basic Buddhist truth that we have to really penetrate into. And, of course, how it applies to us in the sense that we don't have a fixed self and so on. Which means, of course, that we can change. Not only that we can change, but that we will change whether we like it or not, you know, in many ways. The other way to talk about wisdom, of course, is in terms of listening, reflecting, and meditating, which could be applied to all of the five wisdoms. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that cross-referencing for you right now. But listening basically is about knowing the Dharma. It's about knowing what the Dharma is about. What is the teaching? So you're hearing it, you're learning it, you're reading it or whatever, you're understanding it, doing your best to understand it. You know it. And it's not about reading 100 books about the Dharma or listening to every lecture that goes up on Free Buddhist Audio. In fact, the principle of more and more of less and less probably applies, because we don't really know the Dharma just because we know a list. Yeah, you can know the Eightfold Path, but it doesn't mean you really know it. So it's going back again and again to the same teachings and really penetrating into them and understanding them. In a way, that leads on to the next one, which is the listening, the reflecting. So the reflecting is where we're starting to relate the Dharma to our own experience much more. We're applying it to ourselves, applying it to our lives. So we study the Dharma, we discuss it with others, we reflect on it, especially on retreat, when our minds are clearer and so on. And we reflect on our own experience in the light of the Dharma. And when we reflect on the Dharma, we try to apply it to our own lives. So it's this whole thing of experience. We're trying to experience the Dharma. So you know it, now you're trying to experience it. And then the meditate level is where you're trying to embody it. You're trying to actually live it. You live the Dharma. It's no longer something that you just think about or reflect on or whatever. You're actually starting to live it. You can relate those three to the different types, the faith type, the wisdom type, and what's called the body witness, but for another time perhaps. So those are some reflections on the six perfections. I hope you found some of it helpful. And that brings to an end that whole series of talks on the puja and so on, finishing off with the six perfections. And now we go on to a whole different thing next session.